Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, in the midst of COVID-19, at request from some of our listeners, I brought on two of my colleagues, one in hospital medicine and one in surgery and ICU care, to discuss issues that ophthalmologists may face if they are pulled into action to help against COVID-19. First, Dr. Elizabeth Gregg joins me to talk about returning to the wards and handling disaster sort of situations. Next, Dr. Douglas Kwasniewski joins me to discuss ICU management, how to approach returning to an ICU as an ophthalmologist out in practice, and ventilator settings. None of the contributors to this show have any financial disclosures related to this topic. You can find a list of episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. And remember, you can get CME credit for this episode and other episodes on our website. The link will be in the episode description. We'll take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Dr. Kwasniewski will reference a resource for COVID-19. It's https://sccm.org/COVID-19. That will be a great resource to review many of the things he was discussing regarding returning to an ICU and working as an ICU as a non-ICU physician or clinician. Again, we have some pre-recorded retina-related episodes that we'll be continuously releasing. We're kind of mixing in some of those older episodes with some things that are more relevant. This will release, recording today, March 25th, 2020. This will release on March 26th, 2020, and a lot of things can still change. So remember that these interviews were recorded on the 24th, this intro on the 25th, and we'll release this on the 26th. Here's Dr. Gregg. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Elizabeth Gregg. Dr. Gregg is co-director of the Global Institute at the University of Miami, where she is an assistant professor of medicine with a specialization in disaster relief and prior experience in disasters in the Caribbean, including in the Bahamas most recently. Dr. Gregg, Liz, thanks for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be here.
So this is like a giant 10-year reunion. So we're 10 years since we graduated medical school together. And it's also almost 10 years since I started my intern year in medicine, which was the last time I got really exposure to working on medicine floors. And so with COVID-19, many ophthalmologists in the country have received word from the hospitals they're affiliated with that they may be asked to participate in terms of taking care of patients if things get to a point or extent as they've seen in China and Italy, in Iran, and now we're seeing in New York and Seattle, that we may need more frontline providers. So many have reached out to me saying, hey, I haven't worked on a ward in X amount of years. How can I prepare to help in a disaster sort of situation? So Liz, thanks for coming on to talk to our listeners. So first of all, just give them a little bit of background before we talk about COVID-19. Why and the interest in disaster relief specifically for you?
So I got started in this because as a medical student project, I decided to do work in Port-au-Prince about what would happen if there were a major emergency or a mass casualty. And then when we were fourth year medical students in 2009, 2010, I had sort of completed this mapping project and the Haitian earthquake happened. So UM actually pulled me out of school and I spent the latter half of my fourth year of medical school down in Port-au-Prince, running the logistics of the field hospital in Haiti, which was obviously a tremendous mass casualty event that went on for months and months and months. Certainly a different kind of emergency than this one, but some of the same logistical considerations. So, and I worked in disaster management ever since. So did my residency up in New York and Sandy happened while I was up there. Which involved a major shift of personnel across hospital systems in New York City, and then moved down to North Carolina, where I did a lot of domestic disaster response with FEMA, and then finally made my way back down to the University of Miami to get some sun and work in the Caribbean, and was greeted by Hurricane Irma and then Dorian, and now this, unfortunately. So job security, I think, is out there in disaster management, unfortunately. And but this is a doozy. I mean, this is really, really above and beyond. Even I find this like so surreal that I'm having a hard time really comprehending the logistics coming our way. So I can appreciate that ophthalmologists are a little bit nervous about having to go back to the basics. Hopefully it's a little bit like riding a bike. We'll see.
So let's say, and this is perfect because I'm 10 years from the last time I did my intern year, so 9 years since I finished my intern year in general medicine. And most ophthalmologists did some sort of transitional year in medicine. So they have some background ranging from anywhere from a year or two to many, many years, depending on where they are in training. Let's talk first about just getting reacquainted with the wards. I mean, there's references. I'm assuming that there is an equivalent sort of mobile reference to our old pocketbook in medicine. I feel like I'm sad. If someone who's listening to this is a med student, it's probably like, what is this guy talking about? But
every year, but they still exist.
Right. So I would almost consider an ophthalmologist going back to the wards almost like a super powered intern or super powered med student.
Right.
Like what would you tell them to kind of get oriented and started?
Right. I mean, one is like remain calm. I think what you can take solace in is that we're all breathing a sigh of relief that the rest of us don't have to go back and become ophthalmologists. So I think that would be more of the real disaster. And really, you know a lot about general medicine because all of that manifests in what you do every day. So even if you're super specialized, having a physician background and even that intern year will allow you to sort of think critically about diseases and management, and in a way you probably surprise yourself at how prepared you are to be. I mean, there are a couple of things to remember. The difficult things about being an intern, some are just logistical stuff, which I would suggest you would brush up on, because the annoyance of having to learn how to put in an order, for example, in the Cerner system or the Epic system, depending on which hospital you could potentially get pulled to. I mean, that could take up 4 hours of your day, regardless of having nothing to do with medicine, right? So understanding the basic logistics of how to do that stuff, I think everybody should just familiarize themselves with the EMR and like the basic functionality of the hospital system, get a list of phone numbers for consults and everything like that, so that you can sort of function as that high achieving intern. So you've done that stuff before, but actually having that information on hand when you actually need it is going to be majorly beneficial. It's just a logistical hurdle you don't have to tackle.
True. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, keep going.
So logistics aside, all of that, how do I get a chest x-ray? Who do I call for a consult? What's the pager system like? You know, if you're not familiar with that, that'd be good to get a handle on, and certainly something that you could do in advance of potentially getting pulled to the wards or pulled to an outpatient setting. I mean, the second thing is that there's a whole layer, if you can remember from intern year, of algorithmic thinking, you know, stuff that we typically assign to, you know, a sort of nurse practitioner level or a junior resident. For a ton of diseases that we see in the hospital. And it's really important to remember that that just because there's a pandemic doesn't mean that the other stuff that happens that fills up hospitals stops, right? So people will have out of control hypertension, have out of control diabetes. So algorithms for blood pressure management, algorithms for DKA and insulin regimens, all that stuff. Those in particular hospitalize a lot of patients. And I think so that's the second layer of things. And then your physician training, no matter what you've gone into, really like recognition of a critical patient or someone that's not going in the wrong direction. A lot of that is gestalt and comes from, a decade or more of medicine, no matter what your specialty is. And that kind of overlay of being able to think critically about a patient, even if you don't totally understand what's going on or how to exactly fix it, the recognition of things improving or deteriorating, and deteriorating critically, I think you probably have in the bag without thinking too much about it. And that's really what it is to be an intern, right? So if you can use a computer, if you can get through the basics, and you know when you need to call help, those are the sort of three critical things that you would need to function outside of your specialty in a way that you could utilize the resource, you could be a resource to the hospital and utilize the resources of consults and so forth to help you guide you along in management of patients in the most efficient way possible.
So now from a disaster, you kind of touched on this, a disaster relief standpoint, I'm sure you've been involved in meetings, kind of planning ahead, already starting to deal with patients down here in Miami. We're recording this. Again, things change on a day-to-day basis. We're recording this on March 24, 2020, I should mention, since this might be a very different conversation in a week. What are kind of the big things? So for, again, those are more on the big global perspective as a someone pulled to the front lines. Maybe you're just worrying about your day-to-day, like the two things you're assigned to take care of, as you mentioned, maybe algorithms and things that you're assigned to do. But what sort of thinking from a planning perspective do you give about when you're pulling providers from different sort of subspecialty backgrounds? Is it similar where you kind of have certain tasks that would be more appropriate for certain people? For example, I've heard in New York that the people who have been pulled or suggested being pulled, they're being pulled more for screening or for the very front line rather than obviously work in an ICU or run a ventilator, which a lot of ophthalmologists are certainly like, oh, how am I going to run a ventilator? That may not even be required of them unless things get really, really bad.
Right, exactly. I think the worst case scenario planning involves like how many healthcare providers get sick. And so obviously UM is taking extraordinary steps to make sure that that doesn't happen and was very well prepared to begin with, thank goodness. In this interim period where there's not a ton of community spread, but it's lurking and it's on the horizon, those people obviously can slip through the cracks, but hopefully there are very few and far between. And as the situation advances, hopefully we'll all stay healthy in our respective positions. So I think, you know, in terms of the tiered structure, in terms of how people get bumped up the chain, it's exactly that. So essentially, you know, if all the critical care docs go, then the hospitalists replace them and the anesthesia team sort of, you know, functions alongside them along with ER. I mean, and so slipping people in sort of the next best position into the gaps that are most needed will probably happen. And as you become more and more subspecialized or out of the realm of this being your daily business, you'll probably push towards the lower sort of the less technical aspects of how you do it. So I'm sure there's like a very like a tiered contingency planning based on this particular emergency about, you know, if this team goes out, who replaces them and how can you jury rig their subspecialty into falling into the right niche. So I think the internists certainly are sweating about ventilator management because, you know, it's been since my residency, occasional brush up here and there about, but, you know, it's pretty feasible that as a general internist, I would sort of get called up in dire straits to actually need to figure out a ventilator. I hope that's not the case. But it certainly has been in Italy, which is sort of a shocking turn. One other thing to think about is all the outpatient management that actually has to go on to keep people out of the ERs and the complexity of how you manage patients over the phone and telemedicine. You know, that's actually a very difficult skill, even as a seasoned practitioner, to actually manage something over the phone, to be able to get a sense of how critical a patient may be. But that's another role for potentially expanding everybody's capabilities across the health system to keep people out of the ER, to keep people safe at home. I mean, oftentimes what we see in disaster settings is not so much the primary disaster, it's the secondary disaster of having your routine care interrupted. Mm. So you can't get your blood pressure medication. You can't, you know, you can't do your regular monitoring for your sugar, blood sugar control as an outpatient. And then you have a secondary wave of problems where people enter the hospital system in DKA, in hypertensive emergencies and stuff like that. And that's the last thing that we want to have on top of an overburdened ER. So that's another potential role where you're kind of making sure everybody's sort of squared away in a very basic manner before they even need to enter the hospital system in person. So that might be an interesting avenue to think of for subspecialists.
Right. And I think that this is probably a big global issue. Like you mentioned, we're seeing this on our local level with ophthalmology. We have these patients who are kind of in between who don't qualify as urgent or emergent care, and maybe they can be delayed 2 weeks or 4 weeks for their procedure, but we don't know how long this goes on for. And we haven't talked about it because we don't know. I guess we're working kind of on a week by week basis in terms of our policies.
Yeah.
When we meet it. And it,
right.
But that will be a problem at some point if you're a month or month and a half out and you're like, well, we're still closed down except for emergent cases because we need the resources. At what point do you start triaging those other problems? And you could imagine, unfortunately, there's a lot of people who receive some sort of basic care through ERs and through hospitals because they don't have good primary care follow-up. And a lot of doctors in Florida and other states being told, you know, only stay open for urgent kind of matters to prevent community spread. If that continues, right, then it kind of becomes, as you said, blood pressure is one thing. But I mean, even things I've been thinking about patients who are on dialysis, or do we start having to make choices about patients who are getting chemo, for example, who are immunosuppressed?
Right.
Are they going to come into a hospital and get exposed? Are you going to use resources for this patient? How are you handle admitting these patients when you don't have enough beds? These are problems. I'm very grateful. I don't have to think of solutions, but these are going to become issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of space,
and I think
it is
certainly problematic to kind of look at this in 2 week chunks. But as you just described, thinking about like the longer term version of it also becomes so overwhelming because it is such a like cascading catastrophe, right? So that's what keeps me up at night too. I feel that acutely, in that like every time we just bite off 2 weeks, we're really you're bumping that person who needs a, you know, breath biopsy or some kind of moderately urgent intervention, you know, 2 weeks down the road. And if you kick the can long enough, you're going to have a major problem on your hands. So I think, looking up towards, New York, where, everybody has a friend who works in medicine, you know, it's tough to imagine, and knowing that's kind of you 2 weeks down the pipeline, fingers crossed, hopefully not, but, you know, because New York has some unique, population density issues that, we don't have here, but nonetheless, could certainly face a similar scenario. So really, I think people, that we do have the luxury in terms of seeing what other countries have dealt with, because we're not the first one, we're not the first group to go here, right? So seeing how other countries and cities have handled the crisis, and then doing a very rapid evaluation of how well that worked or didn't work, and then replicating or modifying those choices for our own hospital system. And we should just be glad that we're not the first wave here. And that's another common theme in disaster management, that those initial interventions don't get studied. They don't, because there's so much, you know, everybody's hair is on fire. Nobody is actually taking the time to evaluate them as they're happening. And then the next time the disaster rolls around, that's a similar replicatable scenario, you repeat the same mistake. So hopefully people are, and I think we have, there's enough attention on this one that people are watching how it's going in New York. People have been watching how it's been going in Italy, that we'll have the luxury of some lessons learned there.
Liz, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and talk a little bit about this. And hopefully this makes our ophthalmologists out there feel a little better. And good luck. Keep me posted on your progress. And hopefully in a week or two, all this sounds preparative, but not predicting, or maybe not, maybe this, hopefully this is not foreshadowing for something, but we'll be prepared either way.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the way to approach it. Fingers crossed. Thanks, Jay. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good luck.
See you. You too.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now extremely overjoyed to be joined by my very good friend and med school classmate, Dr. Douglas Kwasniewski. Dr. Kwasniewski is a general surgery trained and subspecialized in trauma and burn surgery, and he currently is at Spectrum Butterworth in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I'm calling on Doug because with COVID-19, a lot of ophthalmologists have been reaching out to me how to work in a hospital, how am I going to manage a vent, how am I going to work in an ICU. Doug is a good friend of mine, sits on the mass casualty committee for his hospital, knows a lot about vents. And this is the 10-year anniversary of us beating Ghost Squad on his Wii, which was the last time we faced an apocalypse of this magnitude. So, Doug, welcome back, or welcome to the program. Thanks for coming.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. Thanks for having me on.
So, match day was Friday, 10 years since match day. I was talking to Liz Gregg, who was one of our classmates as well, and she talked a little bit about just getting reacclimated to the wards. But ophthalmologists are getting word from, like many subspecialists are getting words from their hospital systems, from their administrators that, hey, look, as we close elective and non-urgent facilities, and as we have a greater need for providers, we may need you. And especially if other healthcare providers do contract the illness, we may need you to work in various capacities in a hospital. So I've received a lot of feedback from people saying, well, how do I get myself up to speed? What am I going to be doing? And one of the things I talked to Liz about was, you know, hopefully the ophthalmologists aren't the ones running the vents. If they're pulled, they're going to be frontline providers and be working the wards, but they're not going to be the ones in the ICU. But Doug, first, give us your perspective, since you do sit on the mass casualty committee. Now, mass casualties usually occur all at once. You can't necessarily prepare for a mass casualty the same way you prepare for a pandemic. But what sort of lessons have you learned sitting on the committee that you guys have applied to preparing for COVID-19 now?
That's a great question. A pandemic is certainly not something, I think, that when we were putting together the committee, we specifically had thought about. We were thinking more, to be, you know, honest, and, you know, this being the United States, we were thinking more about, like, mass shootings, major car accidents on the highways, pileups like that. Myself and Dr. Carrie Valdez, we're both critical care trained trauma surgeons that are kind of on the committee. And our plan was to literally just have a plan. What's surprising is when you talk to most major institutions, whether it be for trauma, mass casualty, pandemics, anything like that, they literally do not have a plan. And thankfully, that's changing. So most of the major trauma and critical care groups, even from from surgical and non-surgical perspectives, have been in the last few years working on that, and that's really kind of come in useful, ranging from the reallocation of resources and providers to having a plan, to having a specific algorithm. You know, these procedures should be canceled. These are the essential facilities that need to stay open.
So, let's say, and I asked Liz the same question. She laughed at the way I phrased it, but let's say tomorrow someone walks up to you and says, look, Doug, your normal team is not here, and I have an ophthalmologist, a dermatologist, and a radiologist. Sounds like the beginning of a really bad joke. And they walk into Kwasniewski's bar and or ICU, and they're like, hey, what can I do to help? And let's assume that they are ready to learn, eager to learn. How would you get them up to speed? So what sort of things would you tell somebody who's out there in the community, an ophthalmologist waiting maybe to get called? What sort of things should they be reviewing before getting pulled either to some sort of critical care or ICU setting or a setting where there will be many sick patients?
For sure. So one of the things that I've heard, and the phrasing is good. I wouldn't quite say perfect necessarily, but it's good. There are no emergencies in a pandemic. And what that means is you got to look out for yourself first. So probably the very first thing I would do with all of them, with all these folks, would be get them up to speed on how to don and doff personal protective equipment or PPE, because they have to look out for themselves first. Because if my teen gets sick and is not available, then they're not really helping anyone. So that'd be the very first thing I would do.
So they now had a gown and they know how to get it off, and now they are robed. What's next?
So the next thing you want to do is triage. And this is the same thing that applies to a, you know, pandemic or trauma, or even honestly just coming onto the wards, the floors, or the ICU. Even if you're taking, you know, a normal shift and a normal day and nothing at all is going on, one of the very first things you want to do is get together with your team, find out how many patients you have, how much space you have, who is expected to leave, and if you have any estimates for who's going to be coming in, to kind of have a plan for whatever length of time you're going to be there. At that point, then, once you've done that, you want to just do a quick walk around, kind of just literally eyeball everyone there and see who's who. Not necessarily like deep, you know, in-depth rounding at that point, but just to get a feel. You know, if you look in the doorway and somebody's sitting there and they're gray and they're straining to breathe and you need accessory muscles, you know, you're like, okay, this person needs attention now. Whereas somebody who's sitting there, you know, texting or Snapchatting on their phone, they could probably wait a little while, be lower down on the list.
And then let's talk about vents, because I will be very honest. It's been 10 years since I started my intern year. I worked about a month in the ICU during my medicine year. So I know I vaguely have some recollections, some vent settings. We've had lectures in medical school. But realistically, by the time you finish whatever subspecialty training you've done, they've beaten every other piece of knowledge out of your brain. So I will be the speaker for a lot of people out there. It's like, okay, so what do I need to know about vent settings beyond jokes about PEEP and the volume? What are kind of the basic things to understand about a ventilator, the settings, and how they work?
Oh, no, that's for sure. So for it to make perfect sense, I should probably do like a quick review of different types of oxygenation and ventilation you can provide. Obviously, the most simple one is what's called a nasal cannula. That just provides some supplementary oxygen through the nose. The next step up from that would be either a face mask or a non-rebreather. What that is, you know, it's a simple mask placed on the face, with some sort of, you know, with a reservoir bag on it. You can put in a lot more oxygen through that. Although, again, it's not really helping with the ventilation so much as the oxygenation. Oxygenation being supplying oxygen to you, and ventilation being the ability to clear carbon dioxide. After that, the more recent next step that you've been seeing lately is something called high-flow nasal cannula. High-flow nasal cannula is, it's technically a nasal cannula, but it really doesn't look anything like it. There are these gigantic industrial-looking tubes that go through to a cannula that kind of sits within the nose. And there's usually a humidifying machine hooked up to it as opposed to just, you know, simple water bottle for a standard nasal cannula. The benefit to a high-flow nasal cannula is it creates a little bit of PEEP, or positive end expiratory pressure. And that the thought behind that is it helps keep, you know, your distal lung open, the alveoli and whatnot.
So it's the positive
once you get
pressure.
Up, the next step up. Exactly.
Positive end expiratory pressure, so maintaining, preventing collapse.
Right, preventing alveolar collapse. The next step up from that is frank positive pressure ventilation. Now there's invasive positive pressure ventilation, which is being intubated on a ventilator or on a ventilator through a tracheostomy. And then there's non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, or NIPPV. That is your CPAP, your BiPAP machines. And what CPAP is continuous positive airway pressure, CPAP. So what that basically means is you're more or less providing a constant level of PEEP. Your BiPAP is two levels, with the idea that the higher level of pressure, which is your pressure support, is like an inhalation, and your lower level of pressure is like an exhalation, but still providing you that PEEP at the bottom to prevent your alveoli from collapsing. What's unique to COVID-19 is that CPAP and BiPAP specifically make a lot of aerosol that's ejected from the mask with each breath. And so those two specifically are being cautioned against in these specific patients, because you're creating so much aerosol that it kind of puts everyone else on, you know, the team and the floors and wards and whatnot at risk. So I mentioned that just to, for completion's sake, but that's something that most people are avoiding currently. So the big thing that everybody's wondering about with ventilators and whatnot is, you know, invasive positive airway pressure. Like I said, that's usually done via endotracheal intubation or nasal tracheal intubation. The one being through the mouth, the other one being through the nose. That is, then you're hooked up to a ventilator. And like I said, the same can be done via tracheostomy, although you're not going to see a huge amount of these in these situations. The big things you want to look out for are, and what makes vents unique, is the fact that they have what's called an assist control mode, which covers 90% of ventilator patients easily. You can do almost anything on that that you want. The big things you're looking at, like I said before, are oxygenation and ventilation. So the settings that you can adjust are the percentage of oxygen that you're going, which is your FiO2, your PEEP, which is, like I said before, positive end expiratory pressure. These patients for COVID are requiring a lot of PEEP. Your kind of baseline setting is around 5, usually. But these patients are requiring higher levels. When you're looking at the two things you got to do for these folks, oxygenate, ventilate, if somebody is getting hypoxic, going up on the FiO2 and going up on the PEEP, that's what tends to usually help with that. The other side of the coin is ventilation, which is clearing your carbon dioxide. And for that, the settings that you can adjust for that are respiratory rate, which, you know, makes sense. The faster you breathe, the more you're going to breathe off the carbon dioxide. And the other side is either tidal volume or pressure support, depending on which mode you're on. But for simplicity's sake, the most common mode being assist control, volume control. What that means is you're setting a respiratory rate and you're setting the tidal volume. So the tidal volume is the amount of air that's being pushed with each breath. And you're, therefore, when you can set the respiratory rate and the tidal volume, you're setting how much air you're breathing through per minute, which we call the minute ventilation. And by going up on the minute ventilation, you go down on the CO2. So or just you're increasing your CO2 clearance, so the patient's CO2 goes down.
Just to pause and recap for a second, and for myself and for anyone listening. So there's basically, if you kind of sword in your head, as you said, there's things that affect your oxygenation, there's things that affect your ability to get rid of CO2, your ventilation. So the things that affect your ventilation, your factors would be your respiratory rate, whatever rate you set it at, and the tidal volume. Oxygenation would be more controlled by the FiO2, and then things that would improve oxygenation would be things like positive pressure, PEEP, that would help maintain alveoli from collapsing, preventing, you know, local atelectasis. So talk a little bit about, so how do you decide, and this may be complex, how do you decide whether you increase tidal volume or respiratory rate for a patient?
No, that's a great question. So there's innumerable algorithms that you can find of a more or less a baseline vent settings. And if you're honestly, you know, in a mass casualty situation, if you're shooting from the hip, it's fine to start with those. But every, you know, everyone is different and every body is different. So one of the important things, and I'm really glad you asked that question, one of the classic things to know for ventilators is you want to set what's called a low tidal volume, as low as the patient can really tolerate. Your goal is lung protective tidal volume, which means that you're not, you know, causing trauma to the lung with too much air moving through. So you, what you'd like to do is 4 to 8 milliliters per kilogram of ideal body weight. And the importance is ideal body weight. Because, you know, your lungs don't grow with what you eat or how much you work out or anything. That's just your body. So you want to ideally find the patient's ideal body weight and try and set the tidal volume within that. And the way you, that's a good starting place. And the way you adjust it over time is you check an arterial blood gas, which will tell you the patient's pH, you know, their acid-base status. It'll tell you their PaO2, and which shows you, you know, how well their blood is able to oxygenate, how well the oxygen is able to reach the blood. It will give you a P to F ratio, which is the ratio of oxygen in your blood versus the oxygen that the patient's inhaling. The higher P to F ratio, the better job your lungs are doing of moving the oxygen in between, the worse. The lower the ratio, the worse they're doing. And ABG will also tell you their PCO2, which is how much carbon dioxide is in the blood. So looking at those settings, you'll be able to adjust, or looking at those ABG results, you'd be able to adjust the settings based on that. And we usually check that once every 4 to 6 hours, usually.
Beautiful. So that's awesome. That's a great, great primer and recap. I already feel better. I already feel like I know almost enough. I can at least look at the settings and look at an ABG and kind of understand where we're at. So let's just kind of take a step back, because I think ultimately if someone's going to be working in this setting, this will not be enough, and even reading about this once will not be enough. They'll have to know some basics, learn on the fly. There are videos I've seen people online explaining this as well. Any bigger points? So again, you talked about knowing how to protect yourself, knowing how to evaluate who's sick and who's not in an ICU setting. Any final points you would make for someone who is not? Again, I was telling Liz, I almost think of the people you're having are like supercharged interns or med students. They're people with more experience in a lot of ways, but they're kind of more, there's like a level, if you scrape off the rust, there's a level of shine under there, but you're kind of starting from scratch-ish in terms of rebuilding that. So any sort of final things you would tell them before they work in a quote-unquote disaster or a pandemic, not being an emergency, but a disaster sort of setting?
Oh, that's a great point. Like I said, number one point, again, protect yourself. Self-care is the most important thing, because you cannot pour from an empty cup, as they say. So if you can't take care of yourself, you can't help others. One of the biggest things I'd recommend, and it might sound silly, but it's true, all of this stuff is really algorithmic. So if you can find a decent event or management algorithm anywhere, it's probably going to be pretty useful. The Society of Critical Care Medicine at sccm.org has an entire section specifically for folks like you're talking about, you know, that might not be, you know, they might not be doing like vents or ICU or even ward stuff, you know, every day. And so they've got a lot of really good kind of flow sheets and algorithms for that. So having some of that on you would be exceptionally helpful. You can kind of use what we discussed and just check where you are in the algorithm and go from there. Having a plan and having a place to put these people is obviously super important. You know, you guys as ophthalmologists, specifically as proceduralists, you know, canceling cases that can be put off, anything to do, you know, to delay the strain on the system, to lower the strain, is just super important and super helpful, and it's very appreciated from everyone.
Doug, this was fun. This was way too serious. We got to do something more fun at a later time when there's not a pandemic and the healthcare system, as we know it, is in a huge bit of trouble. But anyway, I can't wait to see you guys at the end of all this and see your wife, Steph, and your kids. You guys are of your 10th wedding anniversary this year, and we will catch up after that.
Absolutely.
And social distancing has brought some benefits. Some of my friends wanted to play. I came up with the idea. They wanted to have a happy hour, and I was like, we should play Worms 2 Armageddon. And then I realized there's an iPad and iPhone version of it. Fantastic game. Just throwing it out there. $5. I don't have any financial interest in it, but $5 on the iPhone and iPad to play Worms 2. Who knew?
That would be amazing.
All right, Doug. Be well. Keep me posted, okay? Thanks so much for doing this.
Absolutely. Anytime, man.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can find all 221 episodes. They are sorted by category. Remember that you can find more information on managing COVID-19 at sccm.org/COVID-19. If you'd like to follow us or subscribe for our episodes, you can find them in the Apple Store or Android Store on your mobile device. You can also subscribe to our mailing list when you go to our website at retinapodcast.com.
You can contact us on Facebook, on Twitter, at Retina Podcast, or by email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thank you to Dr. Elizabeth Gregg and to Dr. Douglas Kwasniewski for joining me. Thank you to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Michael Vanacasa, and Dr. Angela Chang, who in addition to be frontline providers against COVID-19, are producing and releasing this episode. Thank you, listeners, for everything you're doing out there in the communities, everyone who's working to help our country and our world get through this. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.